Well, Jim, welcome. Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. We love you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Why don't you go ahead and just introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you're doing currently?
Sure. So my name is Jim Geckler, and currently I'm Chief Operating Officer with Experience Onsite, which is Onsite Wellness, our Milestones program, which is a residential trauma program, the Onsite Workshops, which we've been doing for over 40 years now in Tennessee, in Cumberland Furnace, Tennessee, mm-hmm. and at the facilities in Pomona, California, at the Oaks, where we also have programming. We also do great stuff with the entertainment field. Mm-hmm. We have offices that recently opened the Onsite Wellness House at our location in the Nations in Nashville.
That's right.
Where in the next couple of weeks, we're launching a trauma outpatient program.
Really? Yep, I didn't know
it's
that.
It's going to be an evening group therapy.
Out of there? Out of the Nations?
Yep. It's going to be at the Onsite Wellness House is the new branding. So I will say Onsite Wellness House repeatedly through this as I remind myself. But it's our offices at the Silos in the Nations.
Cool.
And 3 nights a week, 3 hour group therapy sessions with an individual session every week. And we, you know, we had to build that because there was a need coming out of Milestones and the workshops where people mm-hmm. were saying, this is great.
Now what?
Now what?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what I just thought of because I've had many. So shout out to Onsite. We love Onsite. We're neighbors with Onsite. And so many of our friends and some of my family actually have been through some of the trauma work at Onsite. And that was the same kind of issue as, you know, what now? And you're only providing that what now for Nashville, right? But there's what now that happens all over the country that's hard to follow up on. I'm glad y'all are doing that.
So am I. I'm excited about it. So Onsite is also part of my story. So before I came to work here. So prior to being here, I was chief executive officer at a program in Estes Park, Colorado, 12-step abstinence-based mm-hmm. substance use program mm-hmm. called the Harmony Foundation. Great program. Shout out to Harmony. And before that, I was with Hazel and Betty Ford for many years. And I worked in intervention and family consulting before that. When I was at Hazel Inn, I went to Onsite for the first time. So I got sober, and I'm a guy, and I define my recovery as abstinence-based, and I've been sober since February 5th of 1999. So I just had 25 years of continuous sobriety, which blows my mind.
Congratulations.
I'm only 32, so I don't know how that happened. That would be my first lie that I tell today.
Yeah.
But I was unhappy. And I was, you know, angry, and I just couldn't.
How old were you in recovery at that time?
I was probably about 4 or 5 years into recovery.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit, 7 or 8 maybe.
And you were working at Hazel Inn?
I had just started with Hazel Inn.
Okay.
So,
and what was your role then? I can't.
So, trying to remember, was it customer service outreach manager?
I think
was my title.
Sure.
I got to work for John Driscoll, who, of course, we both know. And
yeah.
John brought me on. I was working in intervention before that. But I recently married and had aging parents, and everything was great. And yet I was discontent. Mm. And I had worked the steps. And I kept going back to things that had happened in my life, and I didn't know how to deal with them. And the steps are amazing, but they, you know, we say right in the rooms, it's not the answer for everything.
Right.
And so I went to Onsite. And because of that, I was able to take a different look at childhood trauma, ongoing trauma, my relationship with my folks, and my relationship with men in recovery. I learned how to be a friend by going to Onsite. I think I became a better husband, just better all around. And, you know, because I'm a good recovery guy, I forgot that and then went back and did other work. And it's been, was a key part of my life. And about a year and a half ago, when I was discontent in some other ways, I went back to Onsite for some work, and I kind of realized this is where I want to be. I love and you know, love the work that happens at Cumberland Heights, and I, you know, obviously I know Jay, and we sit on the NAATP board, but I feel like I've made a shift work-wise, and I've gone from working in treatment to working in recovery. And I think that what we're doing, you know, not everyone who comes to Onsite has substance use issues, but we help kind of realign people and say, what's important and where do I want to go and how can I get there? Mm-hmm. You know, what's getting in my way of being the person I want to be?
Mm-hmm. How does that work? Because of course we're familiar with on-site and we love the work that happens out there, and I don't want to give anything away, but how would you describe how change takes place if you are to go to an on-site intensive? Because it's unique.
It is unique. It is unique. And you know, we've been doing it for a long time. Sharon Westheider Cruz started doing the work, you know, years and years ago and traveling around the country, and then came to Cumberland Furnace. Mm-hmm. She and her husband Joe were there for a while, and then Ted Klontz was there, and then Miles came in. And Miles has been there for many years now and really has created this beautiful landing place for people to come and do the work. You know, it's one of those interesting things to describe, because experiential and family sculpting, you know, if I said, well, what's going to happen is we'll go into a room, you're going to put a scarf on your head and you're going to be my mom and I'm going to have a conversation with you that I've never been able to have and won't ever been able to have. And then I'll feel better. You know, it's one of those places where for the first time I was allowed to say, I'm angry with my parents in a way that I hadn't been, and that I still love them. You know, that's there. So through the experiential work, through psychodrama, I was able to have conversations that I'm never going to be able to have in real life. I'm not going to be able to have them because people are dead. I'm not going to be able to have them because some of the people that I've played through conversations with aren't capable of having the other side of the conversation. I had conversations through work, through psychodrama with my dad that he just were out of his capacity to be able to have. And my life became better because of that. You know, so I think it's unique work. It's kind of hard to describe, but we get to the core of what's going on. So I love when I hear from clients, and I probably have said this to other people too, you know, the 4 or 5 days that you spend at a workshop at on-site is like 2 years of therapy. And I've been in therapy since I was in my, you know, probably about 12 or 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So
it's when I hear, so I've got friends that work at on-site, again, just many people that have been affected by their programs. What I hear people say that are really into psychodrama, and if you've been to a conference and they ask you to volunteer in the psychodrama workshop, say no, because it might be an interesting public experience.
Yeah.
Because it's all about show me, don't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience with psychodrama was kind of in graduate school for the first time, you know, and recovery. So what I love about psychodrama is it's very similar to recovery, right? It's not really often has to do very much with what you think, but what you do.
Right.
And so an example of this might look like somebody trying to literally physically place their body in the room as a manifestation of their relationship with their dad.
Yep.
And when somebody asks you to do that, you're like, really? You know, do we really need to do that? But the process of doing that, which is kind of uncomfortable, literally getting your body up, crouching down into a ball or turning your back while everybody's silently just reflecting, is powerful for your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're describing is true in that people go for 3 or 4 or 5 days for one of those intensives and they come back shifted in a way that might motivate them to do things differently following up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, we throw around words like life changing and,
yeah, yeah.
And I think that it, you know, like most opportunities that are out there, it's a chance to make a change.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are people that go through, I mean, I know there's people that go through a month of treatment and come out and say nothing's different and go and pick up right away. And I'm sure there are people that, you know, invest their time and resources in coming to on-site and walk away saying this was not a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
We try to keep that low and try to work with those folks when that happens. But it is around what we put into it to a degree.
Yeah.
We have incredibly skilled guides. We call our folks guides, which I just love, who are the clinicians that come in and do the workshops. I am a tough patient.
Why is that? Why do you say you're a tough patient?
Because I don't come from a place of trust when it comes to care providers. So my dad was a dentist. I grew up around that. Mm. I don't necessarily look at people and take faith in what they say. I for someone who lives in the gray and is pretty good at it most times, I get really black and white when it comes to care. And I remember being in a group and someone said, all right, well, we'll have someone enroll as your dad and we'll have this conversation. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. I just want you to tell me what to do to make this better. Like, well, right. We're going to have someone enroll as your dad. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. I just tell me how to fix this, you right. know? And this was, you know, it's like my story around recovery. I just didn't want to get in trouble anymore. I wanted to stop blacking out. I didn't want to do the work of going through the steps.
Right.
And I think, you know, if there's one thing that we do in a really beautiful way, it's we create a safe container for people to be able to do this work that's hard work to do.
Yeah, absolutely. When you say you're working in recovery and not in treatment anymore, can you tell me more about what you mean there? I think that's really insightful.
It's some of it is about the way people come to us. Mm. You know, we don't have a lot of people who come because of a crisis. Mm. You know, it's something's off. Something just doesn't fit right. There may have been, you know, a job change or a divorce. There may have been some trauma that happened around their life that you know causes the call or the web search or the therapist recommendation or their friend to say you might want to try this. But it's usually not. I've been arrested. You know, my life has not fallen apart. For the most part, at the time that people come to us, it's my life is okay, but it could be better.
Right. You
know? And I'd like it to be better, and I don't understand why it's not better.
Falling apart in a different way than someone might, you know, some emergency, some health crisis related to addiction that's like, I need to stop drinking.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I don't really believe I need to stop drinking, but my wife or whoever told me that I probably should, and they're going to divorce me if I don't show up here. Yeah,
yeah,
it's much different.
Yeah. It's from working in intervention in Hazelden and Harmony. It's, you know, those calls. We got a lot of calls from spouses, a lot of calls from parents, calls from kids. Harmony, it's usually on site. It's the people that want the help that are calling.
Mm.
So it's not someone calling saying, you know, my husband isn't addressing his trauma. Mm. And I need him to come. It's someone calling saying, I was talking to someone who said that they were there for a workshop and it changed their life and they're no longer living in this way and they recognize that I am. And so I'm really interested in finding out about it.
Before we let this go, I want you to describe or just make sure that we talk about that, because there's different types of intensives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
What are those?
So our kind of core product is the Living Centered program. And I think Living Centered is, if you feel a little off in life, it's a great resource.
Is that what you did in 99? Is that what you said? That was the iteration then?
It was a version of it.
Yeah.
And I actually did Living Centered this past summer when I was trying to figure out what was going on.
It's ironic.
It's a great program to come in and kind of have a real overview of things aren't working in my life and I'd like some better direction as to why. We have a healing trauma program, which is focused,
solid.
Yeah. On kind of more acute trauma, people who've done a great deal of work and understand that, you know, what's holding me back from this is a car accident or the death of a parent.
That's a good question. Is there some insight that's required?
No. Yeah. I mean, it's helpful.
Right.
People don't usually call us without a lot of insight. It's
sure.
You know, they don't accidentally pick up the phone and reach us. But it's, you know, usually by the time they're calling us, they know something is holding them up and it might be this. They may leave with a different version of what it was and what they.
Yeah, they leave with a different problem than they were. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Or a different solution.
Yeah.
We have HSL, HSI, which is. Healthy sexuality and intimacy. We've got one of those coming up right now in our Pomona location for men. And that's, you know, people who have struggled with, really looking at sexual addiction. You know, mm-hmm. am I Am I in a marriage, but I'm spending a lot of money on prostitutes or pornography, things that are preventing me from being present in the way that I want to be present. We have healthy relationships, which, you know, sometimes couples come to that, but maybe, and, you know, a common theme in that might be that I'm a childhood sexual abuse survivor. And because of that, I've never been able to connect with someone on anything other than a physical level.
Right.
Or I can't get physical with someone. We do individual and couples intensives, family intensives. And those are intense. It is interesting how many people though call and you know, again, I'm a special guy, so I needed an individual intensive. I benefited so much from being in a group setting instead of an individual setting. And I think the beauty of—
And you've done both?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the beauty of the— Well, I've done individual work. I've not done an individual intensive at onsite, but I've done the individual work. The benefit that I've had in a group setting is I get more work out of what you do and watching you because it's safer than doing it myself.
Right. But of course, we want to opt to the— Let me just have my own weekend, my own care professional. I get that.
And sometimes that's appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's you know, whether they're recognizable people, and sometimes you don't want to be in a group in that situation. We also offer Milestones, which is our residential program, and that's a 30 to 90 day residential stay for people who've been struggling with trauma.
Yeah. Well, I've just been so impressed with onsite. In fact, it might have been the last time that we saw each other was when I was out at your Cumberland Furnace campus. One of the last times,
perhaps. We ran into each other at a coffee shop.
That's right.
Yes.
The time before that.
Yes.
Which I need to give this shout out, and the folks here on my team are going to, you know, they've heard this story 1,000 times at this point, but I called Amelia Baldwin, who works at Onsite, who we all love.
Yes, we do.
And I just said, Amelia, I would really like a tour. And before she could say yes, I said, but not that kind of tour. I'd really, really like to have like a hospitality tour.
Yep.
And she said, no problem. I completely understand. We've had this call before. And shout out to her and another woman who is, I think her name is Paula.
Yep. Paula is the head of our hospitality department.
Who is the MVP.
Yep.
She was so impressive. And for those that have been in Onsite, they know what I'm talking about. Just everything from the straw in the flower bed to the throw pillow in the room, to the furniture, to how things look, to the decor, to the food, to how you're greeted, to the language that y'all use. Just really best in class. And I know that that's intentional. That doesn't just happen with hopes and dreams. There's a lot of work. And the best part was actually going to see her office, which is like a huge warehouse.
You went to Paula's office?
It is because a cool space. Looked like a cross between, you know, and I mean this with all respect, and it looked like a cross between a Hobby Lobby and a Crate and Barrel, because she was prepping for the next season. And I just thought that attention to detail isn't just because she likes things to look nice. It's because creating an atmosphere of recovery, as I might call it, a healing center, the details really matter.
Yep.
And y'all just do such a great job.
Thank you.
What have you— being the new COO there, how long have you been there now?
Since October 1st.
So by way of hospitality, in terms of how things come together, what insights have you gleaned there? What's the secret sauce?
So we have a culture of extreme hospitality. That's how we refer to it.
Okay.
You know, so when
interesting.
You pull in and do that circle up to the Drolliard house and come in for a workshop, there are flags that are flying. There are signs that are out greeting you. The programming team is there, and when you get out of your car, or if you get off of the shuttle coming up from the airport,
they're there.
They know your name. So it's Nick. How are you? Nice to see you. Shake your hand. Take your luggage. Your luggage goes away and is delivered to your room, and you move into a tour of the facility and right to— I mean, it is. And I wish I could take credit for this, but this is Liz with the team that's there.
Yeah.
There's a respect and an elegance to the manner in which it's happened.
Yeah.
I recently, I'm part of a men's leadership group that meets on a regular basis, and I know we share some friends who are there, and we'll have to get you to one of those too. And we just had our group come through. And one of the things that I've noticed before, and I was grateful to hear other people notice, you get up in the morning, you leave the cabins, and the cabins are beautifully appointed, and they're double beds, and people want to buy the linens and the pillows, and you go to breakfast, and by the time you come back from breakfast, the beds are remade, the towels are folded on the bed, there's a note or a gift from housekeeping, and you never see them. It is a beautiful operation that hospitality does, and we use that language too when we refer to our staff. So people that would be called housekeeping, that's our hospitality department.
Mm.
And they recognize that that's their job. You know, their job is not to make a bed and clean a cabin. Their job is to create a beautiful environment for people to get well.
Mm.
The culinary staff, their job is not to cook food and present it. It is to be there for the guests and know that this is their experience and how to make it beautifully. When I was here this summer for the Living Center program, I went through and I'll never forget, Miss Shirley knew my name second day, and she knew that I loved the crispy bacon and not the limp bacon.
Naturally.
I do like some crispy bacon, and we've got wonderful bacon at Onsite.
Yeah.
We also have great vegetarian and vegan
right.
And kosher options too.
Which is true. And a fridge to the side. Yep. I can attest to this. Yes.
Yeah. So we make sure that, you know, whatever your needs are, they're exceeded.
And I want people to understand, like, it's not, it's nice. It's very nice. The amenities are very nice, but it is not over the top.
Right.
Really where you feel it is that spirit of hospitality. You said extreme hospitality?
Extreme hospitality.
That's how you feel it. Everybody you come across smiles, hello, how are you? It's really impressive. Just job well done on maintaining that spirit. Because I think it really matters.
Yep.
You know, like, is it going to cure someone's trauma? No, that's not possible. But having someone care for them in that way for 4 days is something that we're striving for, not for 4 days, but we're striving to integrate that level of extreme hospitality here in some of our programs. Because we believe it really matters in how people are able to change.
Yeah, I remember when I first started working in this field and going to a treatment center. And while we were walking through, we walked by and someone was sitting on a bench and they were clearly emotionally distraught. And I said to them, and it was a marketing person doing the tour, and I said, just should someone talk to them? They're like, oh, well, we don't talk to the clients. That's for clinical to do. So when a clinician walks by, they'll talk to them. That is the opposite of what we do. You know, everyone talks to everyone.
Yeah.
Which is very Southern, I'm learning, is that everyone talks to everyone. From moving to Tennessee, I've learned that. But we want everyone to feel welcome. You know, I had an experience going to a hotel a couple of years ago, and when I pulled in and they came around and opened my door, they said, welcome home. And that's what we strive for.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, this is a place for you to come and take care of yourself. And you should do that in a comfortable setting.
Yeah.
We don't need to have, twin beds with rubber covers on the bed.
Yeah. Right.
And we don't treat clients that need that. You know, it's not detox.
Right. Right.
And so there's a time and a place for that. And
absolutely.
I'm not knocking the folks that have that. But what we do is different.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I ask you this? I'd like to ask you more a personal question, which I'm kind of leading the witness a little bit because we've spent some time in and out of professional experiences.
Are you going to talk about Friendster now? This is not going to come up.
No reference to Friendster. No one look no for one? Jim's Friendster account. I repeat, no one try to find this account. No, I want to ask you about your recovery, if you don't mind sharing just what brought you to the rooms.
Sure. So I started drinking when I was about 12, 13 years old. And started smoking pot about the same time. And I grew up in a nice family.
Where'd you grow up?
Outside of Buffalo, New York, a little town called Lockport.
Shout out Lockport.
Shout out to Lockport, New York. And I grew up in a nice family. And I didn't know how to operate in the system that had been created. I'm adopted, I'm gay, and I grew up in a very, very Catholic connected family. I consider myself Catholic today, so no knocks on Catholicism. This is just a different experience for me as a child. And I, so I was doing this play, Pippin, at the Kenan Center in Lockport, New York. And one of the people who was in the, and I was 12 years old, and asked me if I drank or got high. You know, and I said yes, you know, because I wanted to fit in. I wanted desperately to fit in. And I didn't look, I wasn't like a 90210, 12 years old where I was shaving. You know, I was a little kid. And I drank a Heineken and split a joint. And it worked. I fit in. And I, for that summer, I partied with adults, which when I look back on that, it's kind of appalling. But at the time, it worked. I was an alcoholic from that point on. There was no ramping up. I was a blackout drinker very early. I would sneak. Interestingly enough, I didn't drink Robitussin when I was in high school, but I would pour whiskey into Robitussin bottles, take it to school, and keep it in my locker. Because I thought no one would care if I had Robitussin in my locker, which they didn't. They also didn't care if I had whiskey, but that was another story. But I drank alcoholically, and I'm also, so I am a childhood sexual abuse survivor, and that fueled my addiction. When I was about 25, I lost a boyfriend to an aneurysm and fell deep into drug use. At the time. And from 25 to 30, I was off to the races with cocaine and crystal meth and alcohol and just about anything I could get my hands on. Went to treatment for the first time at 30.
You're still in Buffalo at this point?
No, I left Buffalo to go to treatment in Minnesota.
Got it.
Had a couple of treatment episodes in Minnesota. I remember they, you know, they said, go to outpatient and get a sponsor and do this. And I thought, well, some of those are nice ideas for other people, but they weren't really for me. So I relapsed. I ended up back in treatment. I did some of them. They like asked someone to be your sponsor and do that. So I asked some guy. I never talked to him again, but I had a sponsor. The final time, I had legal consequences connected to my final use, which saved my life. And I just said, I'm going to do everything that they tell me to do. I was terrified of dying. I was more scared of living than dying because I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I got sponsees, and my life got better.
This is in Minnesota.
This is in Minnesota.
In the Twin Cities, I imagine.
I was living in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And lived in the Uptown area. It was a different community now. I lived actually about six blocks from where George Floyd was murdered. So the community that I lived in. Was ravaged by, you know, everything that happened.
The opioid epidemic.
Well, that and just the cultural unrest after everything that happened after the George Floyd. And it went from being kind of an up and coming neighborhood to there's a lot of boarded up buildings now in Uptown. I hope to see it come back. It was a beautiful place to live, and I have great fondness for Minneapolis. So I was working there, or living there. I was working in St. Paul for an intervention group. Met this guy, started dating him. We got married. He was working for Hazel and Betty Ford. It was Hazel Inn at the time. So we bought a house up there, and I joined the team at Hazel
Inn. In Center City?
In Center City.
Wow.
With John Driscoll.
Yep, up there.
Yeah, and so my recovery is 12-step recovery. I worked for Caribou Coffee when I first got sober, then worked for an intervention group, then went to work at Hazel Inn. And all the time was really involved in 12-step recovery. And, you know, that's ebbed and flowed over the years. There have been times where I've been a you know, twice a week meeting guy. There's been times where it was maybe once a month. COVID helped with that. So by the time COVID hit, I was living in Colorado and working for Harmony. And COVID allowed me to kind of rejoin the 12-step community with a level of anonymity. So I found working both at Hazel and Betty Ford and then at Harmony, I would struggle to go to local meetings because there were always people there from the treatment center. and I couldn't go and talk about.
Drop some stuff off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go to meetings when I traveled, but I didn't have a home group. I didn't have that community anymore. And I gained some of that back during COVID because I was able to do that virtually. You know, like I said, I celebrated 25 years of continuous sobriety this past February, which was
so awesome.
It's unbelievable. My husband's in recovery. He's got 27 years. But
you tell him it's about quality, not quantity, right?
Well, he tells me that I have so much to learn and I should just watch him. and his recovery is a little bit different than mine.
Yeah.
And we have different approaches to it. And I think that's great.
Can I ask you a personal question? This will be unexpected. Having your husband in recovery, is that a positive or a negative? I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I think it's a positive.
Okay.
I think there's more wins to it.
Yeah.
I think there are people who kind of understand the tenets of recovery who aren't in recovery. But I think they're kind of few and far between.
Yeah.
It's just nice to have someone that I can talk to the language about that.
They just get it.
They just get it. You know, and it was also nice when we were dating that I could tell horrific stories about my using and not have him walk out of the room.
Yeah. Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah. How did I end up in this nightmare?
Yeah. That's been my experience too. It's one of those things that I really fought for a long time. Like, no, I don't want to, for something, this isn't about me, but there was something within me that wanted to keep it separate.
Yeah.
You know, and the moment I let that go, I discovered something really beautiful. Because like you said, the shared ability to rally around shared tenets is not to be minimized. It's really powerful.
We also didn't meet in the rooms.
Ah.
So that we met through work.
Interesting.
And I dated in the rooms, and that did not work out.
That's what I was afraid of. Yeah.
That did not work out. Because when what I found is, and I had a relationship that I still look back on very, very fondly with someone in the rooms. And when it didn't work out for us, I felt I couldn't go back to those meetings.
Yeah.
You know, so that became an issue.
Yeah.
So I don't think that, you know, the steps stop at 12 and go back to 1. That 13th step, while distracting, I don't think is always a good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I know people have met in the rooms who've had great lives. And,
many.
You know, thousands. We can certainly cling to those few people that have done that versus the people it hasn't worked out for.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a reason why that's suggested.
Yep.
You know, to take your time and to maybe not jump into a relationship. Because look, when we get clean and sober, right? Touch me, hold me, feel me.
Oh,
like let's connect.
Kissing is a great distraction.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and it'll change the way that you feel for a little while. But then, like you've mentioned, the work needs to continue.
Yep.
Whether that's the 12-step work, or whether that's the on-site intensive work, or the therapy work, or the God work, or the higher power work, it all evolves.
You know, as I get older and have been sober for longer, you know, I know far less about it. I'm far less rigid around what recovery is. And I remember hearing people say, you know, I wish I knew everything when I was 20. And I'm like, shut up, grandpa. But, you know, that's where I am. You know, if
right.
I knew much more about what recovery should be at 2 years than I do at 25. I know what's worked for me today. You know, I know how I got to this point. I also know that huge parts of the quality of my life have been grown outside of the rooms. And my recovery is through Alcoholics Anonymous. Drugs are a major, major part of my story, but I found my home in the rooms of AA. I would say that while I found my home there and got stability, I found out who I was in other places. Mm. So through therapy, through work at places like OnSite, through a lot of bad decisions, I found out who I was. And I grew into a guy that I like much more than I dislike, which is not where I was 25 years ago, and someone that I understand today why there's people who like me.
There's people that love you, Jim.
There are many people who love
you. You know?
Me. Yeah.
And one of the things I really love about you is the way that I see you welcoming others.
Oh, thank you.
You know, which really matters. We spent some time at the Wilson House in Vermont, and there's always a few newcomers in the sense to the group, this private gathering that we've had the past few years, and you've always done a good job of making sure that they felt welcomed too. And I think that what my observation today is that speaks to your history, you know, of feeling apart from. And how important that is to make sure that, hey, there is more than enough room for everybody to join, you know? And I think you've probably had an impact too with NAATP, by that way, you know, just to make sure that we stay open, you know? Can you speak to, I thought it was interesting just the idea of knowing a lot more in early recovery versus later recovery. Can you speak to maybe how that idea has influenced addiction treatment?
Sure. Yeah.
Legacy
addiction treatment, right? So Hazel and Betty Ford, was it 15 years ago when the Core 12 program was rolled out?
It's all about MAT.
Yep. All about MAT. The idea that Hazel then was suddenly putting people, you know, everyone was going to go on buprenorphine. You know, I remember being, and I was very much on the periphery of that, but Fred Holmquist and Scott Heseltine and Bruce Larson, you know, these amazing folks at Hazelden who kind of put that model together. Fred was one of those guys that could just quote the big book back and forwards. And Dr. Marv Seplo, who was a chief medical officer at the time, and Mark Mischek, who was the CEO, you know, they really drove home that we want to do this correctly. And if this is against the tenets, then we need to examine that. They did such an amazing job of citing the big book around the reason why MAT is not in violation of, you know, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel strongly that it's not. You know, I think that MAT is a lifesaver for people.
100%.
Now, that was not greeted with great applause and embraced as a liberator in the treatment world.
Not at all.
There was actually, and I don't know whether you were around for this, but there was a Core 12 conference that was formed that was for abstinence-based programs only.
I did not know that.
Yes, and it was in response to this. And I remember going down, it was part of, at the time, the C4 conferences.
Okay.
It doesn't exist anymore, this conference. But it was... this group of people got together and said, no, we need to stick with abstinence only. And there's a lot of passion around it, you know, this goes back to, I wish I knew everything, that I thought I did. I think it was less about knowing everything and more about having black and white kind of fear-based thinking.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And I do see that still in some places, that if the way we're doing it isn't the only way for people to get well, then that must mean that my model is wrong, which is not the case.
Right.
I guarantee that the way I work the steps, there are many people that would say, well, no, you haven't really worked them, or you haven't worked them good enough, or you're not doing it right.
Right.
What I do know is I haven't gotten drunk or high for 25 years. I show up for work. I show up in my family's life, and I'm a good guy for the most part.
Yeah.
I have my moments, but I'm a good guy for the most part. But it was that fractured treatment when this happened. And for Hazelden to come out with it was incredibly brave when I look back. And I think Jolie has done this now, who's Dr. Jolie, who's the current CEO at Hazelden, has done it again in talking more about there are multiple pathways,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there are, you know, I have people that I care about who I've seen turn their life around because of smart recovery.
Mm.
I have people who find the solution to the problems of their life and their addiction through a relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm. You know,
bravo, you know, fantastic.
No doubt.
If that works and you're not doing it and you're not holding up a liquor store or
yeah.
you're holding a job down and you're being honest and you're showing up and being a good part of society, you know, then keep doing what you're doing. I think the hubris that comes with knowing the only way is what kills people.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a moment I had where we had young people leave the Hazelden Center for Youth and Family and die. And this is pre-fentanyl.
Mm.
But this was
right.
young people who, and they do great work there. So this is not about the treatment program, but just in general,
sure.
people who are leaving treatment, their tolerance goes down. You know, and if you're an opiate addict and you go out and you buy something off the streets, you don't know what it's made up of, really. And your tolerance is down and you die. I'd much rather have someone alive and have the ability to stick around and be utilizing buprenorphine, be utilizing methadone in a way that keeps them alive so they can be present.
Uh-huh.
And if they wean off it at some point and have, you know, abstinence, then bravo. If they don't and they lead a great life because they've been supplemented in some way or supported in some way, also bravo. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I really like what you said about it almost challenging our own individual recovery. I remember, I've told this story before here, you know, being early in recovery and being so excited about what I had discovered. So much so that, you know, on like a Southwest flight, I'm like leaning over to the person next to me who does not want to talk to me. And it's like, hey, have you ever seen a step working guide? You know, like, and it's just not the right time. But just, you know, that those first few years of recovery was just so, dare I say, self-righteous
yeah.
about this thing that had given me an entirely new sense of self and identity and just a smidge of esteem. Not much, just a little bit. And purpose and passion. And sometimes we confuse because there's a lot of people in recovery that work in treatment.
Yep.
And sometimes that's a little bit of a blind spot for us because we get so disenchanted with alternative ways to support people. And I think you're right that 15 years ago/
yesterday.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah. That's still an evolving, depending on who you talk to. But I appreciate everybody's ability. Like, we're not trying to convince anybody of doing anything that they don't want to do, right? You deserve to be here, and we would really like for you to buy into a lifestyle where you're going to be making positive choices. It's going to positively impact your life. But if you don't do that, I'm going to keep working my program. You know,
yep.
I suppose I don't need to convince you of what I'm doing for it to be okay with me. And that's
and what you do doesn't lessen what I do.
Right.
I've had people in recovery or people since I've been in recovery say, hey, I've noticed a change in your life. How did you do it? And what does that look like? I said, this is how I've done it. Oh, I went to an AA meeting. It didn't work for me. I'm like, okay.
Right.
That's what worked for me.
Right.
And I hope you find something that works for you.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So
how do you, in your experience, and I know on-site's a bit different, but actually not at all, just in terms of trying to help people adjust the sails as they see fit and as God guides them or their higher power or whatever they choose to believe in. But what's next? You know, where do you see us going, behavioral health? What's the next, what do you see along the horizon there?
I think that we are at a crossroads medically in understanding. So shout out to Forrest and Dr. Annie Peters, who we both love very much,
love.
And the work that the research group here at Cumberland Heights has done. We're finding out better things around outcomes. And I think within that broad outcome study and what we're doing, we're going to find new ways to work with people. And I'm very interested. I don't know where this lands yet, but I'm really interested in looking at the positive effects psychedelics have had in working with people who are struggling with trauma, from ketamine treatment to microdosing. There's enough information out there right now that we need to look at this.
It's interesting.
It's interesting. I don't think there is one great solution to anything. But if we can arm ourselves with more opportunities, and whether that's, if we have someone who is coming back to treatment, to substance use treatment, 6, 7, 8 times, and you and I both know that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
And the reason, the core reason behind what they're picking up around is a trauma issue. And they've done, even if they've done on-site, if they've done trauma work, and they're still not able to get past that, and having ketamine infusion may improve their life, why aren't we trying it? Why aren't we trying it? So I think there's a lot there. I've been really concerned about where the substance use field is going with the heavy use in a lot of areas of certified recovery support people. I know insurance is now paying for time with folks. I'm just concerned about the level of oversight there. I think
by way of like the dichotomy between a residential experience and peer recovery support.
Yeah, and the lack of kind of oversight and supervision
right.
I mean, I'm a community recovery guy, right?
Yep.
It's
I hear you.
AA and the community around AA saved my life. I did not have someone in AA. I had a very clear boundary. They did not talk to me about my medication.
Right.
They did not talk to me. I mean, there certainly were plenty of people, and I remember I had my gallbladder out early in recovery, and I had people saying, if you take any medication, that's a relapse, and you have to start counting your days again. And my sponsor said, that's stupid. If you're, he used a metaphor, and I use this all the time, but if my arm is ripped off in a car accident, don't take me to an AA meeting. Take me to an ER and give me a lot of morphine.
Right,
And then sew it back on and don't give me any more morphine.
Right.
But there's, and I forget where I was going with that, but I love that arm metaphor. But it's, I'm a little concerned about where some parts of the field are going around that. I think from a reimbursement point of view and a shift in the way that clinical staff are available to work in residential settings, I have some concerns there too. I think that we've got a generation now in that COVID wave of young clinicians with minimal experience who are going directly into private practice with minimal supervision. And I have concerns around that. I don't think that's a great way to develop clinical skills. And I do think that one of the beautiful things that residential care has given is for someone who's, whether it's an LADC or an LADC or LPC, is that you moved into a highly supervised setting and you learned how to make mistakes and you learn from people who are seasoned. And now if I can sit at home in sweatpants and a dress shirt and see people through a screen, which I think telemedicine is awesome and carries a huge value, but I worry about what's going to happen in the next 5 years with those folks.
Yeah. There's a lot there. I think that when I think about peer recovery support, I'm with you 100%. There's not a lot of stuff. When you really look under the hood, everybody always talks about peer review and, what the studies say. But if you really dive into it, right, the foundational studies that John Kelly talks about in his meta-analysis through the Cochrane Review, right, just about the value of addiction treatment, there aren't many true residential studies happening today, if at all, any at all. The ones that have been completed in the past were most of them largely based on an indigent population, right? We need to it's like with MAT, there's an access issue there. So like peer recovery support specialists, we call them navigators in Tennessee, having them infused into our communities and emergency rooms to catch people that otherwise might not have the resources to experience a residential stay quickly, because mm-hmm. most of the federally funded programs, you know, have a long wait list because there's not there's an access issue there. There's not enough beds. That's great, right? Let's have as much as that as possible. But I'm with you 100%. We need to make sure that we don't minimize the value of intensive work for the financial.
Yeah, the financial break.
That you get with peer recovery support or just general outpatient therapy.
Yeah.
It's really.
And I think even with the outpatient therapy, you're working at least with a trained clinician.
That's true.
I have great concern around, because I've heard conversations around peer recovery support where they've actually said, you know, I've watched people say this from the stage, because I've been there, I can do better than your therapist can. And I think the peer recovery support in case management, in kind of what you're talking about in emergency rooms, huge value to it. I mean,
to your point, they're making referrals.
They're making referrals.
Like, which is a professional behavior, right? In terms of somebody having somewhat, actually, it's in the most ideal sense, clinical training mm-hmm. to be able to rationalize why it might make sense for you to do X, Y, or Z. And when you have a group of people that are making those decisions, it, you know, it just calls in question how can we effectively help support what's happening with those folks in our community.
Well, if you look at, you know, the 12-step model is peer recovery support, right?
That's true, yeah.
With minimal training too. But if, you know, without good leadership and rules around this, 12-step recovery, I first went to a meeting in the mid-90s, and there were people saying then, and I imagine there's still people today that would say, if you're on an antidepressant, you're not sober.
Yeah.
You know, so if you want to be fully supportive, sober, and work the steps with me, you need to get off all medication.
Yeah.
You know, and people kill themselves when they get off all medication and they're supposed to be on it. So I don't have the answer. I don't think we should throw out peer recovery support, but I'm concerned about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful that you're here. Selfishly, I'm really grateful that you're our neighbor now.
Yeah.
Here in Tennessee. I know you're enjoying it. Maybe not so much of the rain. Well, it's heavy rain here in the winter, but that's okay.
I don't mind it.
I don't either. Yeah. You know, like the introvert that I am, like bring it on, you know? But I appreciate you being here and thanks for spending your time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We love you a lot and we'll see you again soon.